another danger is that positive humanitarian movements aren't the only ones who are organized. There's also right-wing racist and fascist movements organizing. I mean, there's fundamentalist Christians and Islam and Hindu and a lot of very reactionary movements, and we have to out-organize them. But then the other part is the possibility, and that things, the future is more up for grabs perhaps than it's ever been. The power of the empire is very fragile, and movements around the world are stronger and more sophisticated than we've ever been before. So, and what happens in the United States, particularly in the next year, is going to be key. I mean, we have a key role to play in trying to make dramatic global change. And so I've been encouraging people to really pull out the stops and step up to the plate and do whatever we can, which means may mean going to New York City. It may mean doing what you can in your neighborhood or your local community. And for people working around the elections to unseat Bush, to really think about how can we simultaneously build counter power, build movements and organizations that aren't building power for the Democratic Party. That's been part of the problem. But so that when we unelect Bush, we can have a counterforce to carry to force him to not continue the policies of Bush, which are a continuation of the policies of Clinton before him. So I'm very hopeful. I think if our movements, and we need that hope, if our movements are the strategies and organizations, if those, all those are a lantern, then hope is the thing that is the fuel that makes them burn very brightly and attracts people to them. So I think we need to find sources of hope and keep those burning very brightly.
David Solnit, author of Globalizing Liberation. For people interested in doing nonviolent direct action at the upcoming Republican National Convention in New York City, there will be a free training session in Ithaca on Tuesday, August 24th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Unitarian Church, located at the corner of Aurora and Seneca Streets in downtown Ithaca. Trainings will include likely scenarios to be encountered, strategies for dealing with police violence, for remaining nonviolent in the face of violence, and for de-escalating tensions. The trainings are designed to include participants with lots of nonviolent direct action experience and those with none. Everybody is welcome. For more information, call 277-8962 in the 607 area code. 277-8962. If you couldn't write this down, visit bushmustgo.net, where the info is listed in the events section. For a general overview of the protest plan for New York City, visit rncnotwelcome.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
Like a little vacation, like a little old song that I want to hear, like a big libation. Like a flattering sentence whispered in my ear, that's what I want. Every time I try what I'm trying for, so why don't we have a little symposium where everybody takes the floor? How I feel every time. feel like I wanna feel so. Why don't we have a little council meeting and hash out something real? Yeah. Robert's rules of order will be observed. I'll be the parliamentarian with an unswerving dedication.
Once a year in towns all over Vermont, people gather at town meeting to discuss and make decisions in a remarkably democratic forum. On town meeting day, citizens in each town debate and vote on issues that affect their community. Vermont still has a vibrant political culture around its annual town meetings, unparalleled anywhere else in the United States. The culture, purview, and rules of town meeting, however, have changed considerably over time. The purview of town meeting is usually limited to electing the town select board and other city officials, allocating town funds to certain town projects and charities, debating certain aspects of zoning law, and debating funding issues about education and other town expenses. Today, town meeting, though significant, is peripheral to political life in Vermont. Town meeting has deep roots dating back to the American Revolution. Historian and author Murray Bookchin called these town meetings the machinery of the revolution, because much of the resistance against British rule was organized through town government. In 18th century New England, without a fully developed centralized state, people's everyday lives were much more integrated with the political organization of the town meeting than they are today. Centralized state control developed first with the British Empire extending military control over the settler towns, what it considered to be its colonies. Later, Federalist forces within the American colonies who opposed the British were to consolidate power to an even greater extent than any of their British predecessors. Professor of History at the University of Vermont and scholar of Vermont Town Meeting, Jay Moore.
The town meeting system was brought by the Puritan people who came here from England. It was the basic unit of government for people here in early New England. But even bigger places like Boston were run by town meeting processes up through and beyond the American Revolution. The town meetings, just like town meetings today, the main topics on their agenda would be matters pertaining to the local town, attracting a minister in the early days. Towns and the church were basically synonymous, and setting up a school, paying for roads, electing local officials. Those are all kind of the same kind of topics that we, or many of them anyhow, that we deal with at town meetings today. Bigger topics didn't come up on a regular basis at town meeting. It was more a case during time periods of crisis that people turned to the town meeting as a place to discuss things. In the 1680s, when England was trying to crack down on the Puritans here and take away the charter for Massachusetts, people turned to the town meeting as a place to organize resistance to the efforts of the crown to deprive the colony of its charter for self-government. And that was the precedent for the use of the town meetings in the 1760s and 70s in the run-up to the Revolution, when again people in the colonies felt that their liberties were endangered by Britain.
The American Revolution, though parts of it were instigated by progressive and democratic political tendencies, still left many social divisions and oppressions. Town meeting, despite its relatively democratic form, was by progressive standards today highly exclusive in participation. While white women perhaps attended town meeting, they were not allowed to participate in the proceedings that the white men controlled. Furthermore, town meeting was for the colonizers, not the colonized indigenous people whom the white settlers forced westward and often killed. And among the colonizers and settlers, there was major class stratification and political differences about where control was to be held.
Coming out of the Revolution, there are various forces. Some are more intent on seeing that power continues to devolve to the more local level or town level. And for those forces, the anti-federalists lose the battle to the federalists, who want a stronger national government. pretty much the town meeting goes back to being what it primarily was before, a place where people dealt with local issues. But the tradition of people turning to the town meeting when there was a crisis, that continued in force at least for another half a century. During the war with Canada and Britain that we call the War of 1812 in U.S. history, a lot of New England states were opposed to that war, and the period leading up to the war, in the war itself, well, there was actually a secession movement here in some of the New England states. It wasn't, as I say, until the 70s that some people who were new leftists who were looking into possible precedents in American culture for what they wanted to do, which was to shift power back to the more local level and to use that kind of power for social change, tried to reinvigorate the town meeting in this kind of way of bringing sort of so-called non-town issues in front of the town meeting.
The issues that these people brought to town meeting included resolutions against the Vietnam War and later, on a much bigger scale, resolutions for nuclear disarmament. During much of the 1980s, the U.S.-Soviet arms race posed the single greatest threat of nuclear annihilation. People all over the U.S. became involved in the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. In March 1982, 177 out of 195 Vermont towns that discussed the resolution voted for a nuclear freeze, calling on the U.S. to work with the Soviet Union to freeze production, development, and deployment of all nuclear weapons. On June 12th of that year, 1 million people gathered in New York City to protest nuclear weapons, marking one of the largest anti-militarism demonstrations in U.S. history. Joseph Gainza, currently the American Friends Service Committee coordinator in Montpelier, worked on the town meeting component of the Nuclear Freeze campaign.
Because Vermont has a history of direct democracy at town meeting, that had a tremendous impact on the rest of the country. That and the votes in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, which also have town meeting and also similarly voted, as did Vermont. And so that went around the country. There were headlines all across the country that when citizens have a opportunity to vote directly rather than through a representative for a nuclear weapons freeze, they do so in overwhelming numbers.
Similar to the 1812 war with Canada and Britain, threat of nuclear annihilation caused many Vermonters in the 1980s to see their world in crisis. Debates similar to those of the mid-19th century slavery abolition movement about whether issues outside the immediate purview of the town are even relevant to town business resurfaced in the 1980s.
How relevant is the issue of nuclear weapons to town business when towns are voting on school budgets or voting on town budgets or whether or not they're going to buy the new fire truck? Some people were saying this is well beyond our capacity. This is a national government issue and we shouldn't be discussing this. But it was shown that prior to the Civil War, even though Vermont in its Constitution of 1791 had outlawed slavery, so consequently there was no slavery in Vermont, several towns voted at town meeting calling for the abolition of slavery. So it clearly wasn't relevant to town business in that direct sense, but yet it was an expression of the free will of the citizenry of these towns to say slavery is something that affects all human beings. So town meeting has been used to express concerns about other issues other than whether or not a town can afford a fire truck.
So why has it been difficult for people to raise issues in town meeting that affect their lives but don't specifically pertain to the limited purview of immediate town business? Jay Moore.
I think it's in part a reflection of the fact that there is a social change going on in which people, instead of seeing themselves as part of a community in which the town meeting is the main decision-making body, the political and social culture of the country moves much more in the direction of individualistic, more atomistic type of politics. The basic unit is no longer considered to be the town or some other collective entity, but the individual voter. In the early days, another reason that bigger issues would come before the town meetings is that the town itself was the place where you would elect your representative that would go to Montpelier or Boston. And this would be done probably on a consensus basis in many cases through some sort of open voting process, not through an Australian-type secret ballot. In the case of Vermont and some nuclear towns, it isn't until the 60s when there's a major Supreme Court case, Baker v. Carr. The argument is that in the Vermont system of electing representatives from the town, Victory Bog, with its zero population, would have the same number of representatives as Burlington with its 20,000 people. This was taken to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that this was a violation of the right of, you know, people to have, you know, one person, one vote, encapsulating the more individualistic type of concept of the way politics works.
Leading up to town meeting in March 2002, a coalition of groups, including the Institute for Social Ecology Biotechnology Project, Vermont Genetic Engineering Action Network, Rural Vermont, and the Windham County Genetic Engineering Action Group, initiated a call for bringing the issue of genetic engineering to town meeting and reinvigorating town democracy. The groups have claimed that genetic engineering is a threat to our environment, the survival of small family farms, and human health. 31 Vermont towns brought up the issue of genetic engineering, each town deciding on its own specific wording. 29 towns passed resolutions, most resolving to put the town on record as supporting state and federal legislation for mandatory labeling of all genetically engineered food and seeds, and a moratorium on further growing of genetically engineered crops until independent scientific evidence proves them safe and non-detrimental to the survival of family farms. Some towns, citing the failure of federal and state agencies to adequately address the issue of genetic engineering, included language directing the town to discourage using GE crops in the town. A few of these towns have even called for a full local moratorium on the planting of genetically engineered crops. Since the state does not grant towns authority over such matters, it has remained unclear how the moratorium clause would be enforced. Nonetheless, the moratorium issue provoked debate about where political authority should be held and the extent to which people concerned about genetic engineering can rely on federal and state governments for a change in regulations. Barry Oleshnik of the Windham County Genetic Engineering Action Group explains the approach that the group takes.
Individuals or groups have gone to their own select boards, and with education about the problem and show of the numbers of people in the towns that are concerned about the problem, have asked the select board to pass a resolution on their own, which would express concern about the issue and reflect that concern to Montpelier and Washington. In many cases, those select boards have agreed to those requests. In the other cases, individuals have gone around to their neighborhoods, had people sign petitions, which would bring the question to the town meeting so that the community as a whole could express their concern in an official way. Here in Windham County, all eight towns, seven or eight, I can't recall, which brought it to town meeting last year, passed it at town meeting, 100% of them. For most of the group here in southern Vermont, which is the Windham County Genetic Engineering Action Group, it's been very clear to us for quite a long time, and we formalized that clarity most recently, that we are hoping for legislative action on this issue as quickly as possible. We hope that by many towns around the state passing their own individual resolutions of concern, that this will be a sign to the legislators that they ought to do something to reflect that concern.
Other organizations, including the statewide network Vermont Genetic Engineering Action Network, the farmer advocacy organization Rural Vermont, and many grassroots activists all over the state, have also made it clear that through their efforts at town meeting, they intend to demonstrate to state legislators that there is tremendous support for statewide anti-genetic engineering legislation. In fact, farmer and Vermont State Representative David Zuckerman has already introduced four different but related bills to the Vermont State Legislature that oppose genetic engineering. The Vermont Town Meeting campaign on genetic engineering has been catching on. Activists in Massachusetts have been learning from and adapting the strategies of Vermont activists in their own communities. Linda Setchell of the environmental organization Clean Water Action.
Last year, folks out in western Massachusetts heard about the town-to-town effort going on in Vermont and started talking about it and decided that they wanted to pass similar resolutions out in their towns at their annual town meetings. And so I started started running into these various people and tried to put them all together in the same room so they could talk to each other and work together and share information. And the annual town meetings in Massachusetts take place at random times throughout the spring. They usually start in early May and run through the beginning of June. And so about 10 towns went forward to propose resolutions, and one attempted to get a bylaw passed restricting the planting of genetically engineered crops within town limits. And six of the towns were able to pass resolutions, six of the 11. And it was a pretty good success considering, you know, it was sort of a fly-by-the-night activity. We just put it together and people went forward and did it.
Now, in Massachusetts, you have home rule. How does that affect what people can do at town meeting?
It means that towns can go ahead and pass actual laws that are in effect at the town level without state-level approval. So this means in the case of genetically engineered food that if a town wanted to not have genetically engineered crops planted within their town limits, they could pass a bylaw that says, we don't want genetically engineered crops planted in our community, and if you do plant them, X thing will happen to you.
Are there communities in Massachusetts trying to use the power of home rule to make more substantive laws to prohibit genetic engineering?
Because our town meetings are not until May or June, towns haven't decided necessarily what they're going to move forward with. So I would hope that a couple of towns will actually attempt to pass bylaws restricting the planting of genetically engineered crops, but it's really up to the towns out there what they choose to do. One town, the town of Orange, did attempt to pass a bylaw last year, and it was defeated, but it was the last thing on the agenda of a really long evening and came right after a cell phone tower debate. And so I think it went down in a blaze because it was associated with the cell phone tower debate, not because people necessarily had a problem with restricting genetically engineered food. There was just no understanding or no debate and no patience for it, which can be a problem with town meetings as well. They're one day. They should be more than one day. This year what we're hoping to do is use the momentum built from passing town resolutions at the local level to then pressure state legislators into passing legislation at the state level. If enough towns pass resolutions, we can talk to our state legislators and say, hey, there's some bills up here. We as a town have spoken and said we're in support of these bills. We need you to take action to make sure that they get passed. And I think that that's access that the biotech industry just doesn't have, and I think it could be a really powerful movement this year in Massachusetts.
Organic farmer and anti-genetic engineering activist Jack Kittredge has helped organize the town meeting campaign effort in Massachusetts. For him and many other farmers, genetic engineering is not only an issue about food safety, but also an issue about making one's livelihood.
I'm an organic farmer, and I'm with the Organic Farming Association here, and that gives a particular interest to me and my community because not only is genetic engineering technology generally a threat, I think, to our environment, to, you know, our health, but it's a real threat to our livelihoods as organic farmers because the contamination from genetically engineered crops in terms of crossing with non-engineered crops, the pollen, you know, pollination and so forth, is meaning that it's getting increasingly difficult to get non-genetically engineered seed for organic farming, and our customers, you know, they expect that we're not going to be dealing with anything that's genetically engineered. In fact, we wouldn't be able to get organic certification if we used anything that was genetically engineered. And right now it's getting very difficult to get corn, which can be certified free of genetically engineered contaminants. So it's really kind of a life and death struggle for organic farmers. And that is, I guess, why our organization is, you know, in the forefront of the struggle. In some towns, it was easy to get on the warrant, and the resolutions opposing genetic engineering were raised and people voted for them, and it wasn't much of a question. In some places we got on the warrant, the issue was raised, and in some cases there was heated debate. Often in those cases we would not win, and usually the issue came down to a local farmer saying, geez, I use this, you know, Roundup Ready corn or something like that in my operation, and I'd be hard pressed to do without it. And if that happens, then people are tending not to want to vote against the local farmer and put him out of business. So our work then becomes talking to the local farmers and saying, from our analysis, from what we've heard from other farmers, you know, there's some real questions whether it really is economically useful. And then to do some education with local farmers and get them to meet with other farmers who have tried the technology and rejected it would be an important thing that we would like to do, so that we can make an alliance with farmers who are using the technology to get them a little more educated about what's involved. Most of the farmers I've talked to who are using it don't like it. They think they have to use it, but they don't like it. They don't like to sign the license agreements with the companies. They don't like the extra payments involved. They don't like the extra monitoring. But they're hard-pressed economically, and they think that by using Roundup Ready corn, for instance, they're going to save money on labor because they can just spray the heck out of their crops with herbicides and don't have to go in there and do extra passes for weeding. The analysis I've seen say that that's really questionable, whether you really do save money in the long run.
Some people lobby their state legislatures trying to get legislative action on genetic engineering. You seem to be taking a different approach working at the town level. Why is that?
I think we can do a lot more education if we bring it up for town meeting votes. A couple of years ago, we did go to the state legislature in tension hearings in Massachusetts, at least. That process was, on this issue, was, I'd say, pretty much a sham. The legislators often weren't there. They were inattentive. The major decisions were not made in hearings, but were made in little conferences with lobbyists. We obviously don't have the economic or legal resources that the big biotech companies have to get access to decision makers, to politicians. But we have plenty of access in town meetings. We've got people all over Massachusetts who are upset about this technology and who do go to town meeting. And we want to turn the tables and make it tough for the biotech people to, you know, they're going to have to come out to all these little towns and find the town center and find out when the town meeting is and show up if they want to argue it. And most of them won't even be able to vote. So I think we have the strength when it comes to democracy in town meetings.
The upcoming attempt to win Vermont state legislation against genetic engineering will not have been the first. In the mid-1990s, dairy farmers and grassroots community organizations began to organize against recombinant bovine growth hormone, or RBGH. The hormone is produced in industrial vats by genetically engineered bacteria and then injected into cows to increase milk production. RBGH causes mastitis infection and a host of other health problems in cows, and activists have raised public health concerns about what this milk may do to humans. Furthermore, many small farmers have regarded RBGH as a threat because even before RBGH, the market was already producing more milk than consumers could buy, driving down the price that farmers could get for their milk. Further increases in production were sure to further undercut milk prices, forcing even more farmers out of business. The movement attempted to fight for state legislation to label milk products that were produced with a genetically engineered hormone. Anthony Polina, a recent candidate for lieutenant governor on the Vermont Progressive Party ticket and founder of Rural Vermont, says that a central issue in the legal debate was whether or not RBGH milk was different than regular milk.
Monsanto used to run these ads in the newspapers and magazines that had a glass of milk and some cookies. And the ad said, RBGH, it's always been in your milk, or something like that, making you think, well, you know, it's fine. Their argument was that the milk from RBGH-treated cows was exactly the same as milk from non-treated, non-injected cows. And that's not true. I mean, the milk from RBGH-treated cows has a residue of recombinant bovine growth hormone, and it has something in it which changes the milk. It has a residue of a synthetic hormone, which regular milk does not. And it also has elevated levels of insulin-like growth factor, which is a health concern for a lot of people. So we began to make the argument based on that research that, in fact, the milk was or is different. And it's a significant difference.
During the debate on RBGH in milk, Brian Tokar helped found the Vermont Biotechnology Working Group, a coalition that instigated much of the activism against RBGH.
Well, it really started with the farmers. And actually, to trace the story, you'd have to go back to the late 80s when we were starting to hear that Monsanto and other major drug companies were trying to rush the commercialization of BGH, which, of course, is a genetically engineered growth hormone for dairy cows. And rural Vermont got involved fairly early on, seeing based on reports that were coming in from farm groups around the country that this hormone would be a serious threat to the survival of small farms. And we developed a Vermont biotechnology working group that included rural Vermont, a number of people active in green politics, including Greens from Burlington, as well as here in central Vermont, people from the progressives and others concerned about this technology. BGH was finally approved by the FDA in late 1993. Senator Leahy had gotten a provision into the FDA's funding that imposed a three-month delay, so it didn't actually come onto the marketplace for dairy farmers to use on a commercial scale until early 94. And during that legislature, in the winter of 1994, there was a push to get statewide labeling legislation for BGH products.
The state did pass a law that allowed for some labeling, and the state was then sued for passing that law by the International Dairy Foods Association and others who were funded by Monsanto, the big dairy cartels.
So immediately the question became, would this law be enforced and how? The Howard Dean administration made it very clear that they wanted to devote as little resources to defending this labeling as possible. In fact, there were questions about whether they would even allow it to be implemented at all. But there was enough public pressure that they had to play along. And finally, a compromise was reached behind the scenes with officials from the state and lobbyists from rural Vermont and Vermont PIRG, Public Interest Research Group, that instead of requiring manufacturers to put on their label that they were using BGH, that the individual Vermont grocers would have to label their shelves. And that led to what became the infamous blue dot scheme, where grocers were getting these half-inch blue dots like you would get in any stationery store and popping them on their shelves at the places where the products that contained BGH were. And they were supposed to have signage indicating that products with blue dots probably contain milk from cows that have been injected with this genetically engineered hormone. In reality, the enforcement and implementation was very slack. Most people never had any idea why these blue dots were suddenly appearing all over the supermarkets and grocery stores. And it really became a bad joke. At the same time, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has always been pretty much in the pockets of agribusiness and the big food companies, was agitating more and more that this was an unfair increased burden on the small mom-and-pop grocers around Vermont. By the time this compromise got hashed out, the thing had dragged on for 6 months. It was easily 6 months after the law had passed that finally BGH labeling in the form of blue dots on the shelves began to be implemented. And still, the various trade associations came in with their lawsuit. They sued the state. The federal district court ruled against the suit and said that the labeling law was okay. Then the industry went ahead and filed a federal appeal. During this time, in the course of preparing their defense, Vermont, in order again to basically spend as little money as they could on this, developed a defense based strictly on consumer preference.
The state actually made a strategic or a tactical mistake, if you want to call it that. Perhaps this was intentional on their part. The state chose not to make human safety arguments. The state said at the time that the FDA found it safe. So how could the state possibly say it's not safe? So the state's argument to allow labeling and to protect the law was simply that Vermonters preferred it, or they preferred having the right to know, and they deserved the right to know, so that consumers in Vermont could support the kind of milk that they wanted to consume. They talked about the economic impacts and how Vermonters wanted to support Vermont farmers and felt that BGH would be bad for farmers. based on the fact that, well, Vermonters just have the right to know and want to know. The corporations came back, Monsanto and others, and said, but there's nothing to know. And you cannot force us to say that our product is or is not produced with RBGH, fundamentally because two things. There's no difference. That's the argument the companies were making, is there's no difference between the two kinds of milk, number one. And along with that, there's no test to show that there's a difference, so nobody could ever confirm it. But they also said that legally, you could not compel the corporations to say something that they did not want to say or felt was untrue. So you could not force them to speak, in a sense.
Because of that misguided strategy on the part of the Vermont Attorney General's office, the Federal Appeals Court eventually shot down Vermont's BGH labeling law on what all of us were just completely stunned by at the time, which was a First Amendment basis, claiming essentially that Monsanto and other corporations have the right to refuse to speak whenever they wish to refuse to speak, and that Vermont's labeling law was violating Monsanto's First Amendment right to only speak about what they wish to speak about.
What was the role of grassroots activism at this time?
The activism that was happening was all in defense of the labeling law. Every time there was a danger of it being weakened by the legislature or not adequately defended by the Dean administration, rural Vermont put a lot of resources and a lot of time and energy into mobilizing its membership to make the appropriate phone calls. So it was all focused on defending the law. I think the campaign to defend Vermont's labeling law was really disempowering for people. It was one defensive battle after another, and it really wore people out. So the first lesson is that campaigns need to be carried out in a way that's much more proactive. The second lesson is something that Vermont activists, I think, have learned well, but people in other parts of the country are still figuring out around genetic engineering, is that labeling is never enough. Here in Vermont, we had labeling, and it was shot down. And of course, with the current generation of genetically engineered crops, it's even clearer that a rule based only on labeling would do really nothing to protect farmers, nothing to protect us against the clear environmental hazards of genetically engineered crops, and ultimately would serve the needs of those consumers who can afford to pay a little more for safer food. It would make GE-free yet another niche market for people who are a little bit more affluent, and really do very little to fend off the long-range hazards and the long-range threat of genetically engineered agriculture. Certainly it's a step in the right direction, and certainly if we had labeling, it would scare a lot of companies into thinking twice about using genetically engineered ingredients. And that's why the industry, for example, was able to raise $6 million to fight the labeling initiative that was on the ballot in Oregon last November.
In November 2002, citizen groups in the state of Oregon began a statewide ballot initiative and referendum for Measure 27, which would have required mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods. This was the first time that there had been a statewide referendum anywhere in the U.S. for such legislation. Similar to the legislative initiative in Vermont to label recombinant bovine growth hormone, the Oregon activists focused entirely on mandatory labeling for GE products. However, different from the Vermont initiative, the Oregon referendum to label GE food attempted to directly involve Oregon citizens as decision makers. Jeff Peckman of the activist organization Ballot Initiatives for Good Government worked as a consultant for the Oregon campaign.
The most important part of the campaign, I believe, is that it engages the citizen in a role as lawmakers. By putting them in the role of lawmaker, it inspires much more personal participation in the outcome of these laws. And it's known that having ballot initiatives on the ballot increases voter participation and the percentage of people that vote in any given election. And of course, the campaign itself, because it was the first time that the biotech industry and food industry might have had to adhere to certain provisions in the law that they didn't want, it became a very big issue to them, and that's why they spent $5.4 million to defeat it.
President of the organic food company Emerald Valley Kitchen and organizer for Vote Yes on 27, Mel Bankoff.
$5-plus million came in from CropLife International, which probably the main player is Monsanto, and they were able to just basically buy the airways for about a month, 5 weeks. And with so many other things going on in the world, I think people just bought into the message after a certain amount of repetition. Prior to the election, the polls were reading like 60 to 36 people in support of the initiative. After 5 weeks of misinformation and constant inundation about safety of and benefits and the exaggerated cost of what it's going to cost, the impact on farmers, it shifted from final vote being just about 70 in opposition to labeling and 30 in support of it.
Similar to Monsanto and other agribusiness talking heads in Oregon, the Vermont Grocers Association is strongly opposed to citizens taking issues of food into their own hands and away from the federal government, which traditionally legislates in the favor of agribusiness. President of the Vermont Grocers Association, Jim Harrison.
It is our belief as an industry that it is the role of the federal government to establish and enforce standards that ensure safety in our nation's food supply. Certainly a safe food supply is paramount to all of us. It's also important to have national uniformity and consistency so that we don't have inefficiencies. If a resolution calls for individual state labeling, the cost and complications of dealing with that in a state like Vermont are just astronomical. It wouldn't make a lot of sense from a practical and economical standpoint.
Alongside the development of centralized state and federal governments and massive corporate conglomerations, town meetings have persisted in Vermont political life as a vestige of the more vibrant tradition of earlier days. The office of the Vermont Secretary of State, Deb Markowitz, who is responsible for explaining the intricacies of state law to local towns, has been closely watching town meeting.
Is town meeting in decline?
Certainly, as compared to the early years of Vermont, it's in decline. Since the state has become less agricultural, it's become in decline. And that's because when communities are principally agricultural, March Town Meeting Day on a Tuesday is convenient for people to come to and spend the day. If anything, they're just missing early sugar ape, so there's not a whole lot pressing for their time. You know, we have a very different kind of society now. We're no longer just an agricultural state. Is town meeting, you know, on its way out? I don't think so. And that's because town meeting really plays a special role in Vermont's communities. It's an opportunity for people to get together face to face, to see neighbors, to feel empowered, because through conversation you can come up with compromise and really educate each other and learn about the town and the issues facing a town. The challenge, though, is that it is hard for many people to get the time to be able to come to town meeting, and so participation is down.
More towns are turning toward voting by Australian ballot, where voters fill out a secret ballot in a booth instead of voting on public questions, where citizens gather with each other in a big room. The results for voter participation have been mixed.
For communities that hold only a traditional town meeting, there's about 20% turnout. For towns that vote only by Australian ballot, there's about a 30% turnout. In both cases, it's an anemic turnout. The real downside of Australian ballot is there's no opportunity to persuade and then compromise. Australian ballot are yes-no votes. You know, it's voted up or it's voted down, and if it's voted down, you've got to come back to another election to vote on the new proposal. So I think it's a different kind of democracy. It's less empowering, I think, for people who participate.
Gwen Hallsmith, who has been involved with political issues at Vermont Town Meeting, wants to make sure that town meeting stays viable.
I certainly wouldn't want to see anything done in the state that would constrain our democratic ability to organize, because I think we're one of the few places in the world where it's still possible. You know, even around the United States, there's a lot of cities and towns. They don't have town meetings. They have city councils or mayors that are very powerful, and a lot of the citizens don't have a lot of control. I mean, you've even heard the expression, you can't fight City Hall. You know, that's how a lot of people in communities feel in the rest of the country. And yet here in Vermont, because of town meeting, you certainly can fight City Hall, or you can even talk about federal government and state government if you want to at the town level. And I just think it creates a different kind of character. It creates a different kind of person. And I really admire Vermonters for that.
Vermont town meeting has been rife with controversy over various legal and jurisdictional issues. At Vermont town meetings in 2002, in addition to the issue of genetic engineering, citizens discussed resolutions calling for instant runoff voting, closing the nuclear power plant at Vermont Yankee, and using a document called the Earth Charter as a guiding document for town decision-making. The Earth Charter, which was written over many years by various international civil society organizations, articulates a wide-ranging set of principles for ecology and human rights. Gwen Hallsmith largely initiated the campaign in Vermont. She says that a few Vermont town select boards, with the support of Vermont Secretary of State Deb Markowitz, failed to fulfill their legal obligation to warn resolutions signed by 5% of the town's registered voters.
The only legal difficulty I had was in a couple towns, Bethel and Bristol, where even though the select board were presented with a petition that was signed by over 5% of the voters, which is a legal requirement for getting a question on the town meeting agenda, they both refused to put it on the warning.
The same year, the Bristol select board also struck a resolution against genetic engineering, and both the Plainfield and Wookett select boards struck a clause that called for a town moratorium on planting GE seeds before citizens could even debate it. Furthermore, in Massachusetts, a few towns had similar legal difficulties warning resolutions, even though Massachusetts has home rule. Organic farmer Jack Kittredge.
And lastly, we had cases where the selectmen wouldn't even put the issue on the warrant, even though it was legally signed and petitioned for. And in Massachusetts, if you have 10 voters, registered voters, who sign for something to get on the warrant, the selectmen don't have the option. They have to put it on. But nevertheless, in some cases, they turned it down and said, you know, take me to court.
Vermont towns that refused to warn certain petitions did so with the support of Secretary of State Markowitz's legal opinion.
The role of our office is that we give advice to cities and towns about what the law requires, particularly with elections, but with many areas of municipal law. It's always based on our judgment and experience looking at case law and statute, but it's not a ruling, which means that, you know, ultimately a court decides where there's a gray area. Because we're not a court and our job is to try to keep cities and towns out of trouble, we always provide the most conservative advice, the advice that's designed to keep them out of trouble wherever possible.
The advice, nonetheless, is quite influential. One very significant statute upon which the Secretary of State's office bases its advice is a governance principle called Dillon's Rule, which is specific to Vermont.
Dillon's Rule is the principle that the municipalities, the cities and towns, are creatures of the state. They're created by the state and therefore controlled by the state. What it means is that towns in Vermont don't have the power to decide what their problems are, decide some solutions, and act without legislative approval. In most states in the union, the relationship between towns or cities and the state is governed by home rule, which gives the communities independence from the legislature. There's always a lot of conversation about whether or not we ought to change to home rule. I'm an advocate of that, actually, but the legislature is resistant because it's giving up some of their authority and power. Every year around town meeting, we get lots of calls from communities who are receiving petitions and want to know, do they have to put them on? Don't they have to put them on? You know, what are the rules? And there's a bunch of rules. What's confusing, though, is the statute. If you look at just the law simply says if 5% of the voters come in with a petition to put something on the warning, that the town has to put it on the warning. That statutory provision has been modified over the years by cases. And the most important court case says that the board does not have to put on the warning an article that is illegal or beyond the authority of the board.
But Vermont lawyer Jack McCullough has argued otherwise. In 1990, Chris Wood of Montpelier helped bring a resolution to Montpelier Town Meeting in support of a peace dividend since the Cold War had just ended. However, the select board refused to warn the resolution. In response, Wood, with McCullough's representation, successfully sued the city. Citing the case law in which Superior Court Judge John Meeker ruled in Wood's favor, McCullough said that unless a resolution is explicitly vested in another governmental body, it is required that resolutions signed by 5% of the town's registered voters are warned on the town's agenda as written. He says that it's a violation of town law for select boards to strike properly petitioned resolutions before citizens even get a chance to debate them. McCullough's objection pertains only to the ability of towns to discuss and vote on resolutions, not to enforce them. Even resolutions that direct a town to enforce a law for which the state does not grant the town specific authority, for example, a town moratorium on the planting of genetically engineered seeds, have no state statutes upon which to build a legal basis for anything other than advisory declarations. The Vermont League of Cities and Towns has weighed in on the debate, arguing that non-essential issues to running town business can actually hinder town democracy. The League describes itself as a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization owned by Vermont's municipal governments. The League provides all 246 municipal governments in Vermont with various services, including legal services. Dominic Cloud is a League spokesperson.
The League of Cities and Towns would support the right of select boards to have discretion in what they put on their agenda for town meeting, their warning. And we would take it one step further. We would suggest that filling the agenda with items that citizens don't have the ability to actually act on begins to impede the act of democracy. What we see is the most powerful act of democracy in town meeting is taking action on things as a community, on things that are within your purview. And to the extent that you spend a lot of time at town meeting discussing topics that you can't act on, you run the risk of not being able to act on items that you can act on.
Gwen Hallsmith sees a much more expansive role for town meeting.
Town meeting form of government is the only place where, as citizens, we have a real voice and a real vote. We obviously vote for representative governments elsewhere, but town meeting is where we have direct democracy. And so the possibility of engaging in dialogue and education with our fellow citizens is there. Now, it's true that there's a lot of town business to conduct. But in fact, since so many decisions at the state, federal, and even international level trickle back down to the town level in one form or another, whether it's losing our jobs or growing our crops, as in the case of genetic engineering, or educating our children, whatever it is, a lot of decisions at a higher level of the government do have an impact locally. So I don't see any reason to limit town meeting discussion and voting to only those issues that local governments control. I'm a real firm believer in democracy, and I think that democracy is no better illustrated than in our local town meetings, where as normal citizens without vested interests, without powerful lobbyists breathing down our neck, without corporate contributions that allow us to be reelected to office, we can consider issues that affect our lives and debate them and make decisions about them.
Dominic Cloud questions whether it's appropriate to use the democratic town meeting structure for expressing dissent with the activities of the rest of the government.
There's lots of opportunities, I think, to express dissent. The question ultimately becomes, is town meeting the best vehicle to express dissent? And we would say that if a select board feels that they would like to take the time at town meeting to occupy the floor time with expressions of those activities, then more power to them. But we also recognize that given the limited one day a year for town meeting where the town needs to take action in approving the budget, we certainly respect their right not to include those things on the agenda. A local government doesn't have the power, for example, to pass new laws on genetically modified foods. And if, for example, and if they would like to take some time on the agenda to discuss it, we'd certainly support their right to do so. But they also should recognize that that's something that's outside their purview to affect. And so they take that action at the risk of being unable to act on other things that they do have the authority to act on just from a time management perspective.
The time limits of town meeting day impose significant limits on how fully fleshed out discussions can become. But citizens are not legally bound to hold a town meeting only on one day.
Most select boards meet every other week, and the statutes provide for, and the technical legal term is a special meeting, in which case the select board can call a meeting at any time. So while the town meeting is the one day out of the year when they have a specific slate of activities at which they need to take action on, citizens are free to gather and to use the town hall as a place to gather to discuss these items, and the select board has lots of opportunities to solicit inputs from citizens either at their regular select board meetings or to convene a special meeting to talk about issues that are in front of a local community. So those vehicles on the local level exist for people gathering more than just that one day a year. They just have to take advantage of them.
But will they? Will people have the initiative and the political will to make town meeting take on greater prominence in town decision-making, or will people settle for state and federal agencies and corporate conglomerates to govern them? And will people take it one step further to demand that they have direct control over all issues that affect their lives? Organizer Brian Tokar.
I think when people have a chance to debate crucial issues in an open, face-to-face setting where a decision will actually be made by a community on the basis of that discussion, I think it helps raise people's expectations that, yes, indeed, regular folks here in Vermont and anywhere can and should claim the right to make the basic decisions that affect our lives.
Thank you for listening. This documentary was produced and narrated by Ben Groskup, who, in addition to being an independent journalist, is also a student intern with the Institute for Social Ecology Biotechnology Project. You can reach him at stokingthefires@riseup.net. That's stokingthefires@riseup.net. Thanks to the Free Media Network and WGDR for technical support. Music is by Vic Chestnut. This program is anti-copyright, March 2003, and free to rebroadcast. To receive a CD copy of the program, send $5 to Ben Groskup, 1116 Maple Hill Road, Plainfield, Vermont, 05667.
If you'd like to contact this program, you can get us through our website at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.